Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, November 21st, 2016, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleform conference call discussing Professor Alexander Bickel's last work, The Morality of Consent. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we welcome our experts. We have with us Jim Hayes, former attorney and alternate judge of the U.S. Department of Labor Employees Compensation Appeals Board. We also have with us Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean and Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine, and Jack Park, of counsel at Strickland Brockington Lewis LLP. Today I will turn it over to Jim to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for questions. Thank you all for speaking with us. Jim, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Nate. I appreciate it. And I want to certainly thank our panelists, Dean Chemerinsky and Jack Park. We're here to talk about a book that is somewhat unusual as law books go. Certainly Alexander Bickel was one of the distinguished professors at Yale University Law School in the 1960s and the 1970s. His life was unfortunately cut short, so we have some books that he has written, and we may wonder what he might have written had he lived longer. But the book that we're talking about today, The Morality of Consent, was in manuscript form when Professor Bickel died. It was a combination of notes from lectures and magazine articles, and it is really not a very long book. It's under 200 pages, which is kind of unusual in this line of work. The book itself, because of its origins and because of the condition that the manuscript was in, can be viewed in two ways, really. First, as a collection of independent essays, with each chapter of the book kind of standing separately and being interesting in its own right, and then also as a whole, because many common themes exist among the different chapters of the book. Professor Bickel was concerned primarily with writing a description of what he viewed as two different approaches to American law. And very briefly, he talked about them as contractarian on the one hand and Whig on the other. He plunged back into history and said that the father of the contractarians was Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the French Revolution, and that the father of the Whig perspective on law and society was Edmund Burke. He traced an American path for these two sorts of separate views of the law. His contractarians that he spoke of particularly were Hugo Black, Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren, Chief Justice, and Roger Taney, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court back at the time of the Civil War. Bickel used fewer names when he was talking about the Whig school of legal and social theory. He spoke of Oliver Wendell Holmes. He spoke briefly of Felix Frankfurter. But he seems to have devoted most of his effort to trying to understand and perhaps rescue the perspective of Edmund Burke from an obscurity back in the early 70s and in the 60s. And so he devotes a lot of the first chapter of his book to describing the two different paths, sort of a two roads diverged in a shady wood kind of approach. We will get into the dichotomy that Bickel gives us as we talk more about the book. But essentially, he speaks of the contractarian theory as being one based on a primary assumption that rights, values, laws are derived from a pre-existing kind of contract or set of values, almost Platonic ideals, which the law and society as it evolves must attempt to approach more and more closely. The Whig view that Bickle talks about is based upon the notion that the here and now is all that we have, that human nature doesn't change very much from century to century or millennium to millennium, that human corruption, human virtue, human desire, human limitations are with us always, and that society and law best serves its purposes if it accommodates and compromises with the things which cannot be changed in human existence. With that as the sort of overall sort of theme of the book, Bickle then talks in chapter two about the distinctions between laws granted to persons and laws granted to citizens. And the question there is whether or not Roger Brooks Tawney in the Dred Scott decision told us, showed us the perils of allowing a system of rights within society to be granted exclusively around the concept of citizenship, which Bickle maintained was the product and controlled by the government rather than rights inhering in persons who have an independent existence outside of government. Then in chapter three, Bickle talks about civil disobedience, because the United States in the 1960s and 1970s had gone through turbulent times with the civil rights movement and the destruction of the segregated South, the anti-war movement, and the increasing protests against the war in Vietnam, and finally a reaction led, or at least symbolized by Richard Nixon and the silent majority as a slogan, kind of leading to all of the matters that we associate with Watergate. And Bickle raises the question of whether or not these kinds of different, certainly, movements and challenges to the American system of law sometimes fed on each other and produced questions about what was legitimate and what was not legitimate, the role of civil disobedience and lawbreaking, whether it was civil rights marchers in Selma, whether it was Daniel Ellsberg choosing to release the Pentagon Papers, or whether it was the Watergate burglars involved in breaking and entering and political espionage. Bickle is able to discuss each of these different sorts of events that took place in his lifetime and to place them in the context of law and challenges to law as being ways by which society as a whole decides which laws it accepts, which laws it wishes to obey, which laws matter, and which laws society will ultimately choose to change through the institutions of government. In chapter four, he goes into, Bickle discusses civil disobedience in greater detail, and in the moral duty and limits of civil disobedience, he tries, perhaps not entirely successfully, to give the reader at least a descriptive list of the ways in which the claims of the person who engages in civil disobedience should be judged. Bickle certainly believed that there was civil disobedience which was harmful, civil disobedience which was ultimately good, civil disobedience which was destructive to the system of law, to the tools of lawmaking, to the consensus that is necessary for law to exist, and civil disobedience which led to a more wholesome discussion, understanding, and reform of the legal system. That is a very brief overview of a rather interesting chapter in the book. Finally, chapter 5, Bickle talks about the moral authority and the intellectual. And here, there's almost an intensely personal, almost confessional quality as Professor Bickle talks about the turmoil at Yale University in the 70s and the role of, intellectuals in trying to, on the one hand, participate and be involved and responsive to society and its demands, and on the other hand, to survive and to preserve the notions of intellectual undertakings, reason, measured discussion, and a grip on reality on the other. And certainly, when one reads this chapter, you get the impression that the moral energy for this book comes from Professor Bickle's personal experience and his reaction to it. And to some sense, in some sense, a kind of a grieving over some of the things that happened at Yale. The question, perhaps, that we are left with is whether or not this is a pessimistic book or an optimistic book, whether or not it is properly a book of about the law, or whether it is a book about moral philosophy and politics, or whether it is, in fact, the personal reflections, almost the memoir, of a gifted law school professor. Having tried to give a very abbreviated version of the skeleton of the book, I would now turn it over to Dean Chemerinsky and ask, is this, in your view, a pessimistic book? And whether it is or it isn't, how well has the book endured over the 40-plus years since it was published?
Thank you so much. Thank you for the wonderful summary of the book. Thank you for including me in the conversation. I think it is a pessimistic book. I think that Alexander Bickle did not like the 1960s. He didn't like the Warren Court. I can talk more about that. He didn't like the Berger Court in the initial years of the 1970s. He didn't like what was going on the Yale campus and was troubled by a lot of the civil disobedience he saw. He also didn't like the Nixon administration. He makes clear in the book that he's the one who litigated the Pen and Papers case in the Supreme Court successfully against the Nixon administration. So here's a man who's just lived through 15 years, didn't like anything that he saw, not from the Supreme Court, not from the presidency, not on his college campus. And I think all of this comes through. Now, as you emphasized, but as I'd also stress, this was 5 essays that were put together after his death. Whether he would have put them together in this way, whether this is the way he would want them presented, we can only guess and we can never know. You asked the question, has the book aged well? It's hard to say. In some ways, yes, I think that for conservatives, I think many of the things that he would say said then would resonate now. He was very critical of the Warren Court. He had the view that the Supreme Court should proceed very carefully. On page 26, at least in my edition, he says, the court's first obligation is to move cautiously, straining for decisions in small compass, more hesitant to deny principles held by some segments of society than to affirm comprehensive ones for all. Now, I don't know that conservatives necessarily believe that today. I think of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, or District of Columbia versus Heller, or Shelby County versus Holder. Those are hardly examples of judicial restraint. He's very critical of Roe versus Wade. In fact, on the next page, page 27, he expresses his criticism of Roe versus Wade. That's something that conservatives would echo today. It's at the end of the book, but he's very condemning of any form of affirmative action. He doesn't develop the argument. He just mentions that affirmative action is to be decried. Maybe the passage that I found most ironic in history is at one point he says it would just be unthinkable that the Supreme Court would ever find that homosexuals have the right to marry. On page 74, he says, nor is the court very likely to tell us that fostering heterosexual marriage, when not counting homosexual unions, which what the legal order does, of course, is unconstitutional. We can't blame him for not seeing what was going to happen 40 years later, but it does give the book a dated feel. So, yes, I think that conservatives could read these things and say, he got it right with regard to his criticisms. On the other hand, as a liberal, I read it, and I think his criticisms of the Warren Court are unfair. I don't think he really develops the arguments as to why Roe versus Wade and affirmative action are misguided. And I found remarkably unhelpful the whole discussion of a contractual view versus a Burkean Whig-type view, which the book is grounded in. I think it, to a large extent, drew a false dichotomy and not one that's very illuminating. So I had read the book many years ago. I reread it again in anticipation of this call. And my takeaway is that I didn't find it to be a very illuminating book. I think that the criticisms of the Warren Court and of Roe versus Wade have been done by others and done better by others. And I think he was wrong with regard to that. And I think he was terribly unfair in discussing the Warren Court.
Jack Park, what do you think? Is this a pessimistic book, and has it aged, or should we be turning our gaze elsewhere?
I agree with Dean Chemerinsky that Bickle didn't seem to like what he had seen over the 15 years preceding the publication of the book. I do think, though, it's almost a Whig view of history that there's this slow organic process and of change, and process is the change, is the vehicle. He seems to say, particularly in this discussion of civil disobedience, that process is all we have and we have to live with the results. So to the extent that he talks about things in the 1960s and 70s, it is dated in that respect, and it depends on either you're having lived through them as well, or you're going back to history and being aware of it. So there's that. As with Dean Chemerinsky, what I was going to start with is my copy has a note that says I got it in January 1978. And I underlined it like I read it for class, but I don't remember what class it was. And like most of us would say, after 38 years have passed, some of the things that I underlined I probably wouldn't have underlined today, and some of the things that I didn't underline would be underlined today. I do, though, think that his discussion of consent or his understanding of consent is important, and we need to keep it. That is continuing. Somehow we do better if we think we're all engaged in a common enterprise, and elections, including the last one, which demonstrated that the country is pretty closely divided, nonetheless give government the power to proceed. And so we would talk about that as consent. It empowers the government to proceed. It gives it a warrant, and when the Congress is divided, you know, we get something approaching gridlock. So there are measures of consent, but I think elections are one great empowering vehicle that reflect consent.
Erwin, I was curious about your sort of statement that Bickel didn't really like the Warren Court. It's a little bit more complicated than that, isn't it? Alexander Bickel was a liberal in his time, and I don't get the sense from the book, with the possible exception of Roe versus Wade, and there's much criticism of Roe versus Wade. He's hardly an outlier. That Bickel would have quarreled too much, at least with the outcome of most of the Warren Court decisions that would be lauded in law schools today. So, how explain a little more, if you feel like it, about this attitude that I agree that that Bickel was critical of how the Warren Court proceeded. And actually went so far, and this is not really a measured book. What Alexander Bickel does have to say, he says without any pale pastels, he says that the Warren Court, on occasion at least, used reasoning and even language that was not unlike the language that would have been used by Roger Taney and Dred Scott. Leaving, assuming that this is just the rhetorical level of the book, it's a short book, it's a collection of essays. As you point out, we don't know exactly what he would have written if he had had more time with it. The paradox of essentially liking the Warren Court results, but not particularly caring for the Warren Court's methods. Can you enlighten us on that?
Sure. I think you understate his criticisms of the Warren Court. On page 120, and this is at least in the version of the book that I have, the assault upon the legal order by moral imperatives was not only or perhaps even most effectively an assault from the outside. As suggested, it came as well from within, and the Supreme Court had it 50 years by Earl Warren. Pause there for a moment. The assault on the legal order was headed by Earl Warren. That's strong language. That's not saying that he's going to mince his words about his views with regard to the Warren Court. He goes on later in that paragraph and says that basically what the Warren Court did was forget about things like process and just do what it thought was right and wrong. And he says, but legal technicalities are the stuff of law, and piercing through a particular substance to get a procedure suitable to many substances is in fact what the task of law is most often about. He then even goes further. And he links the Watergate break-in to what the Supreme Court had been doing during the Warren Court era. And that's on the bottom of page 121. I don't see the causal connection between the Warren Court and the Watergate break-in, but I think what Bickel is saying is once you say the ends justify the means can be things like Watergate. So I think he is very strongly critical of the Warren Court. Since he doesn't discuss specifics, it's hard to know which decisions he's most focusing on. He was a clerk to Felix Frankfurter. Felix Frankfurter dissents in Baker versus Carr, saying the court shouldn't get into the political thicket of reapportionment. Is that what he's focusing on? He does use the phrase that some of the most important decisions of the Warren Court, so that may be things like Baker. Maybe it's cases like Miranda versus Arizona. Maybe it's cases like Griswold versus Connecticut. How much are you right that he would agree with those results? How much would he disagree with the results and would say the court had no business getting them? But I think when you look especially at the language in that chapter, it is so strongly critical of the Warren Court that it overwhelms anything positive he would see in the Warren Court.
Well, it is. I take your point, and our views could differ on that as to how deep or how passionate the criticism of the Warren Court's methods were. But the book, as far as I read it, with the exception of Roe versus Wade, does not criticize any specific Warren Court holding. And you could think that, as you point out, where Bickel goes line and verse on defects that he sees in the Warren Court, and he's very specific, that if he thought that the results ultimately which the court reached in the field of criminal rights or in the field of civil rights were wrong, that he would have waved those like a banner as a way of strengthening or at least making his criticisms of the Warren Court consistent throughout. But I guess it was on page 120, and Bickel is specific, and I'm not sure that we would all disagree with him. If he's correct, he says on page 120, when a lawyer stood before him, that is Chief Justice Warren, arguing his side of the case on the basis of some legal doctrine or other, or making a procedural point, or contending that the Constitution allocated competence over a given issue to another branch of government, than the Supreme Court, or to states rather than to the federal government, the Chief Justice would shake him off, saying, yes, 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 but is it whatever the case exemplified about the law or about the society? Is it right? Is it good? More than once, and in some of its most important actions, the Warren Court got over doctrinal difficulties or issues of the allocation of competencies among various institutions by asking what it viewed as a decisive practical question. And that practical question being, is it right? Is it good? I don't think those are blanket condemnations, and I don't think that the judicial vices that Bickel is talking about are limited to the Supreme Court. I've seen a few judges in my time of much more obscure courts who sometimes gave in to the same sorts of temptations and caused the same sorts of problems for lawyers who appeared before them. So it does seem to me that either you agree or you disagree that the Warren Court was principled in its deliberations. And in that case, either Bickel is right or he's wrong. But to say that Bickel just simply didn't like the Warren Court and leave it at that, perhaps that isn't at least where I would come out on the book.
Might I quickly respond, because I do think we disagree. Part of it is that this is written so abstractly without examples, it's hard to know what he had in mind. If he had examples there, we would be able to talk about it. But as you said, there aren't footnotes. I don't know if he's talking there about the reapportionment cases or the school prayer cases or anything else. Also, I take exception to your saying, was the Warren Court principled? Because we have to unpack, what do we mean by principled? I think lawyers are always glad to call the cases that they lose unprincipled rulings. Overall, I think that what Bickel has done is a caricature and an unfair caricature of the Warren Court. I think the Warren Court was far more concerned with following procedures and justifying results in terms of precedent than Bickel gives it credit for. And I'll go back to where I started. He calls this the assault upon the legal order and says it was headed by Earl Warren at the beginning of the paragraph you described. I can't see how words that begin, the assault upon the legal order was headed by Earl Warren, is anything but a condemnation of the Warren Court.
I think we agree there. The only difference that we might have is that I would see it as a more narrow condemnation than you do. And I think you're perfectly correct in saying what's not there is not there, and that if Bickel had written a longer book with more examples, people discussing the Warren Court and Bickel's opinion about it would have more to talk about. If we could move on for a second, I was interested in getting both of your opinions about the persons or citizens chapter in the book, which doesn't talk a lot about the Warren Court. And at first it would seem to be somewhat out of place. And yet, of course, questions of citizenship are very much in the forefront of political debate here in the early 21st century. Do you think that that chapter has anything to commend it for readers today? And Jack, I would just begin with you.
I'm not sure it fits with the other chapters, and so but as Dean Chemerinsky said, with the criticism of the Warren Court, this is maybe where what he would have included and what he wouldn't have. These were lectures that he gave at Yale, and the book comes from the notes and the manuscripts for those lectures is the way I understand it. So I'm not sure it is Burkean, I guess, because he says governments give citizens rights. If you're Lockean, you'd say there's a circularity to it, that citizens create the government that in turn recognizes some of their pre-existing rights. So, I'm not really sure how it fits in. If he doesn't like Tawney, it's a good way to bash Tawney for Dred Scott, and he's not alone in bashing Tawney for Dred Scott.
We might even have agreement here that Professor Bickle was at least correct in disliking, among the other things, that he didn't like in this book. He spends great length going over the intellectual case for the Dred Scott decision. Erwin, does this chapter seem like it belongs?
No, I agree. I don't think it quite fits. We've no idea, again, if Bickle would want it to be there. The distinctions between citizens and persons have come up since this was published. I think of Plyler versus Doe in 1982, where the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional a Texas statute that says that children of citizens and lawful resident aliens got a free public education, but children of non-citizens have to pay for their education. The Supreme Court, in opinion by Justice Brennan, said equal protection safeguards persons. It's not limited to citizens. I also think, of course, of the current controversy over immigration and what rights, if any, non-citizens, including non-citizens who are undocumented, are entitled to. But I don't think any of that is what Bickle possibly contemplated when he wrote this.
And I don't think he had in mind a case like Evenwell versus Texas, which tried to put citizenship in the context of vote dilution.
Jack, would you expand on that for those of us who are not up on our Lone Star jurisprudence?
It involved, I think it was the Texas congressional plan or Texas...
Both houses of the Texas state legislature.
Legislative plan. And the question is, how do you count the people? You've got to come up with districts that are reasonably equal in population. Well, what is that population? If you count total population, there are people in the total population who cannot vote, and primarily those are immigrants who are not naturalized. And if they can't vote and you count them, that can dilute the votes of districts where those immigrants do not live. And the distinction was striking in Texas. There are pretty substantial differences, and I think it's largely difference between rural districts where the folks don't live and urban districts where they do tend to live. But the court said that it was the court said it was okay to count total population. It did not say that it's arguably left the door open for a state to use another measure, for example, registered voters or citizen voting age population, but it didn't say that that would fly. So, and the district would certainly look differently if we used registered voter data or citizen voting age population. But, you know, at the end of the day, the court said it was okay for Texas to count using total population, including some people who cannot vote and therefore should not.
Well, I agree with your characterization, though I would put it slightly differently. Ever since the early 1960s, when the Supreme Court articulated the rule of one person, one vote, it's always been understood to mean that for any elected body with districts, all districts must be about the same in population. The Texas legislature looked at total population and drawing districts for both of its houses. The challengers said that the Constitution requires that districting be based on eligible voters so that every eligible voter would have the same influence. And the Supreme Court said unanimously that the Constitution does not require that districting be based on eligible voters. Total population is constitutional. Justice Ginsburg writes for the court and stresses the long history and tradition of districting on the basis of total population. She makes the practical point, we have a measure of total population, the census, we don't have one of eligible voters. And at the end of her opinion, she very powerfully says, an elected official represents all constituents, citizen and non-citizen, adult and child. The court doesn't resolve the question whether it would be constitutional for districting to be based on eligible voters, because that wasn't the issue before it, but the end of her opinion sure suggests where the court would come out.
She does tend to suggest that that would be the result, and using registered voters simply moves the problem to the quality of the voting rolls. People who have moved or people who have died have not been removed from the rolls, then you end up with a population that cannot and does not vote or should not vote. The dead certainly shouldn't. But that's all in the context of the citizenship versus personhood chapter in Bickel's book.
So Bickel makes a point of what he sees as the evolution of the law post-slaughterhouse cases away from privileges and immunities, which he takes, I would say, to be citizenship is a government-created artifact. Personhood is an act of nature. That to the extent that government defines citizenship, it also defines privileges and immunities in a different way than the path in the 14th Amendment, which Bickel says our jurisprudence did take, which was using due process and equal protection to establish rights which might otherwise be established or perhaps not be established under privileges and immunities. In this sense, is this still a sort of viable distinction to make, or is this all settled law and the Privileges and Immunities Clause is just the darling of the professoriate, as one Supreme Court justice put it, but they're not the court is not going to take that seriously?
This, Jack, in one of the recent gun cases, I think it was McDonald, the lawyer for the gun owner challenging the law, sought to ground the right to carry weapons in the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and the court was having nothing of it. I think and they gave him what he wanted without driving down the Privileges and Immunities road, and I think that road has been closed ever since the slaughterhouse cases, and the court compensated by finding another avenue, substantive due process.
I agree, though I don't know that anything is necessarily closed off forever. There is a difference between privileges, immunities, and due process equal protection in terms of citizenship. The Privileges and Immunities Clause says no state can deny any citizen the privilege, immunities, and United States citizenship. Due process and equal protection say no state can deny any person of equal protection of law or deprive the person of life, liberty, or property without due process. Interesting what significance there is that for one sentence in the 14th Amendment it used the word citizen, and for other sentences it uses the word person. I've always thought that the logic of the 14th Amendment was that the Privileges and Immunities Clause is what protected people's rights, that the Due Process Clause is what required that the government follow appropriate procedures before taking away those rights, and that Equal Protection required that the government justify differences in the treatment of people. But because of the Slaughterhouse cases, the Privileges and Immunities Clause has largely been closed off. There's one case in 1999 that used it for the right to travel that's never been overruled. In McDonald, the majority of the four of the five justices in the majority indicated that they don't want to revive the Privileges or Immunities Clause, but maybe some future court will decide to use the Privileges and Immunities Clause, as Justice Thomas suggested in his opinion concurring in the judgment in McDonald.
I agree, but I think, you know, there's a lot of water under the bridge since the 1870s, and I will expect more development under the substantive due process prong than I before seeing the Privileges and Immunities Clause revived. But that's just my opinion.
I agree.
Well, did either of you wish to sort of add anything to your discussion of the book before we think about perhaps turning to questions that we might have from listeners? Dean Chemerinsky, you started off saying that that you thought the book was interesting and overdone, almost operatic. That raises the question of whether or not it is, in fact, or should properly be considered a book about the law rather than a memoir or a series of essays or a political book in which ideas and are not quite so constrained and fleshed out as we are used to having them in straight, perhaps legal writing, putting that in quotes. Is this do you like the book any better if I'm not saying agree with it, but like the book any better if we consider that it might be a work of philosophy or it might be a work more in politics, or once again it might be, as I suggested, a memoir rather than a legal tome?
I fear that you've set up false dichotomies in the way you presented that. I think this is unquestionably a series of essays. It was based on lectures, perhaps based on New Republic articles. It is about law. We've just been talking about all the different ways that it touches on legal issues. It also is about political philosophy, but there's an obvious intersection between law and political philosophy. I think it suffers compared to some of his more classic works like Least Dangerous Branch because it's not a sustained argument. It's just, as we're saying, a collection of five essays.
I agree that it's not sustained and doubt it could be sustained in its present form. And as we've suggested, he may, had he lived, not have chosen to sustain it in this form.
Well, very good. Would anyone like to revise or extend their remarks? And if not, we'll ask Nate if he has anybody who would like to ask a question or two.
Sounds good, Jim. Happy to do so. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request a floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your phone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. As we're waiting for people to line up in the queue, I just have a programming note that we are planning to have our next Teleform conference call tomorrow afternoon, Tuesday the 22nd, and that will be a litigation update on the new overtime rules from the Department of Labor. And we have Lawrence Van Dyke, Solicitor General of Nevada, and Jesse Panuccio, partner at Foley and Lardner LLP, who will be joining us for that call. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Currently, our lines are wide open. Jim, did you have any follow-up questions that maybe you wanted to ask of the experts? It looks like we may have exhausted all of their questions. We currently don't have any questions currently.
Well, that is fine too, and one of the most important rules from vaudeville on is knowing when to get off stage. I think that there's been, you know, that we've touched upon different views of this book as essays or as something else, and I would recommend looking at it as kind of a period piece, if nothing else. One may or may not find anything enduring in it, but nonetheless, like any sort of piece of glass or seashell that you pick up on the beach, it does have its own character. It is the reaction of an intelligent and sensitive observer of his times. To that extent, it is unique. I don't think that many historians looking backwards would be able to summon the immediacy that Alexander Bickel brings to these essays, and that in and of itself would be sufficient to provoke someone to disagree or to agree, but we cannot take away the fact that Alexander Bickel was there, and that at least for that reason, as a reporter, as a reflection, as a commentator on his time, he is worthy of perhaps more attention than he gets, particularly the totality of his work. I agree with Irwin that the morality of consent is of more interest as you read the other books and articles that Bickel has written. But that said, unless there is a clamoring to get through on the telephone lines, I think that we can call this a wrap, and I will once again thank our participants.
Well, very good. I think we've had a very productive and enjoyable discussion. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.